negative impact on the dollars comes down to three main things. First, overusing the dollar as a sanction tool, which forced the other countries to build alternative systems faster. And second, reducing the dollar role in international trade through the trade wars, which weakened its foundation as a global currency. And third, eroding the US international credibility, which shakes the dollar's relevance. However, at this stage, the dollar still has a lot of resilience as a global currency. That's because the US sophisticated financial infrastructure and its economic and technological strength, and the fact that no other currency is fully ready to challenge it yet.
This is the social section of the program. Trump's tariffs have created a drop in sales of various agricultural exports, including soybeans. Data shows the U.S. is losing out on billions of dollars in purchases from China.
Add to that President Trump's tariffs, which have created a drop in sales of various U.S. agricultural exports, including soybeans. Data from the American Soybean Association shows the U.S. is losing out on billions of dollars in purchases from China, which spent over $3 billion on soybeans in the second quarter of 2024. So far has spent $0 this year.
Feels crazy that this needs to be said, but here we are. You need raw materials and equipment to make things. Tariffs on aluminum, steel, and machinery raise costs for U.S. manufacturers and make them less competitive. This is economic self-sabotage. Breaking, China has dumped half of their U.S. Treasury bonds since 2012. De-dollarization is accelerating. And while the media distracts you, the financial ground is shifting. China just dumped U.S. Treasuries to 2008 levels. Congress banned CBDCs. Trump is pushing Powell out and putting the dollar on the blockchain with a U.S.-backed stablecoin. Now, while on the dollar, this from The Economist article, China is ditching the dollar fast. To be clear, China is nowhere close to replacing the dollar as a reserve currency and won't be anytime soon. What it is doing, though, is slowly eroding the dollar's influence by building pipes around America's post-Second World War dominant role in the global system.
These tariff wars are definitely hurting the American consumers and the soybean producers. You may be aware that the U.S. soybean farmers actually wrote a letter to President Trump telling him that they have sold zero soybeans to China this season. China used to be one of our biggest, if not biggest, consumers of American exported soybeans. So that is quite devastating to those farmers, and there are other areas as well. There is such a thing as an actual protective tariff, but it requires having the industry that you're trying to protect. They're not supposed to be punitive like sanctions against other nations, so it's a very short-sighted policy.
China isn't just first to dumb the dollar. It's the opening shot in a global exodus. Since Trump swaggered into office, the dollar has been sliding downhill, and now it's tanked harder than any point since 1973. That's not his strength. That's the world's reserve currency being gutted on his watch.
I don't think that the whole world is going to leave the dollar or the majority, but nations, particularly of the global south, particularly those that we have applied tariffs and sanctions to, are choosing to have the flexibility to be able to have trade without the dollar because the dollar has been weaponized. The new development bank of the BRICS still very much relies on the dollar, whereas they just had this incredible meeting in Tianjin, China, of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, where they proposed a development bank which will not rely on the US dollar. As an American, I have to say that I think a better option would be for the United States to stop behaving as an imperial overlord and look for ways to collaborate in a friendly fashion with those nations where they are growing very rapidly, eradicating poverty, and have a bright outlook for the future as opposed to the direction that we're currently heading. Using the dollar as a weapon is not helping the United States, and other nations are finding ways to get around it and to trade in their own national currencies.
This is the Info News section of the program, France's economy. Fitch hits France with record low credit score. The agency linked the cut to growing political instability. The EU's second largest economy has one of the bloc's highest debt levels after Greece and Italy, at about 113% of the GDP. Its deficit is projected at 5.4 to 5.8% this year, well above the EU's 3% limit. U.S. arms sales to Israel. As U.S. hurdles toward government shutdown, White House urges $6 billion in new arms sales to Israel. The request to Congress includes $3.8 billion for 30 Boeing AH-64 Apache helicopter gunships, $1.9 billion for 3,250 infantry assault vehicles, and $750 million more for parts and power supplies. Our special investigation into this request comes as the U.S. government balances are on the brink of insolvency after Senate Republicans and Democrats blocked each other's rival plans to borrow more money to keep the lights on. Iran's a snapback. Iran says Europe ignored a logical offer based on baseless excuses. A day after Macron accused Araghchi of lacking agency, the E3 caved in to U.S. pressure and officially began a snapback of U.N. sanctions. Our special investigation reveals that these sanctions would have no major impact on the Iranian economy, especially since it does not involve its banking sector. Iran is already among the most sanctioned countries in the world. UK-US tech deal. The UK's £31 billion tech deal with the US might sound great, but the government has to answer these questions. In the US itself, data center developments have led to rising energy bills, to disrupted water supplies, while supporting remarkably few jobs. This is the in-depth section of the program. China is taking over the reins from the U.S. It has advanced economically, technologically, militarily. At the same time, Trump's tariffs war with China is hurting U.S. farmers, where they have suffered from record soybean exports to China, further exacerbating their dwindling sales. U.S. imports from China crashed to their lowest point in 19 years, dropping to just $64.8 billion. Exports to China also tanked, falling nearly 30%, as overall trade between the two giants shrank dramatically. The U.S. trade deficit with China got smaller, but only because the total trading relationship is collapsing fast. For decades, this partnership fueled globalization. U.S. manufacturing has contracted for a sixth straight month in August as factories dealt with the fallout from the Trump administration's import tariffs, with some manufacturers describing the current business environment as much worse than the Great Recession. Now, let's bring in Dr. Yang Jing, Assistant Director and Research Fellow of the Guangzhou Institute of the GBA. Doctor, my question, there is a theory that if over 100 nations agree that if they simultaneously dump the U.S. dollar and end the petrodollar system, which has kept America's counterfeit empire for 50 years alive, this will crash the U.S. economy. Is this a theory or no, it can be a real possibility?
This is a really intriguing question. If over 100 countries decided to dump U.S. dollar simultaneously, it would mean that the dollar system had hit some kind of the disruptive event, and the international community was determined to abandon the system they have relied on for decades. But Trump's actions have certainly damaged the U.S. dollar status, but not to the point of an outright collapse. There is an old Chinese saying, it takes a century to build, but only a moment to destroy it. But Trump has shown us that the dollar system might be more fragile than we once thought. But we also need to ask, are there other countries or currencies ready to step in as an alternative? For those participating countries, dumping the U.S. dollar could trigger wild fluctuations in their own currencies, higher trade settlements cost, and reduce the efficiency in the global trade. Does that really serve their interest? And on a global scale, a massive sell-off could spark a new financial crisis with volatile commodity price affecting the energy and the food security worldwide. And in addition, while Trump administration isn't a great at contributing to a global governance, is pretty effective as a disruptor. So is the international community prepared for that? So personally, I think the safest path right now is a gradual systematic push towards the currency diversification.
Turns out Trump is losing the trade war versus the Chinese. One of the signs is the trade deficit. The U.S. trade deficit was 47% larger in first 6 months of 2025 as compared to 2024. We can see from the first 5 months of Trump's second term that the trade gap has widened significantly. The U.S. manufacturing levels shrank for the sixth consecutive month. China's annual manufacturing value added is now over 60% larger than that of the U.S. This was driven by a pullback in production that shows manufacturing remains bogged down, according to the Institute for Supply Management's Manufacturing Index. More proof that Trump has zero clue in what he is doing is seen here. Chinese purchases of American oil are down 90% year on year, while Chinese purchases of Canadian oil are up 700% year on year. What's the impact on the U.S. economy? $20 billion annual loss for the United States at $60 per barrel. Now, let's bring in our other guest, Diane Sir, political analyst. Diane, there is this theory that if over 100 nations simultaneously dump the U.S. dollar and end the petrodollar system, which has kept America's empire alive for the past 50 years, this will crash the U.S. economy. Your thoughts on that?
I think that this scenario is not going to occur, and I will use a different example, which is a battle in which I have been very interested to get the United Nations to invoke the Resolution 377A, Uniting for Peace, to see if one can overcome the veto of the U.S. in the Security Council to do something to stop the mass murderous policy of Israel in Gaza. And what unfortunately seems to be the case is some nations which deplore the policy are still too afraid of jeopardizing their relationship with the United States. Therefore, I think that you're not going to get a bloc of nations to do such a thing, and I think it's very urgent that those of us in the United States have a big responsibility to change the policy of our nation so that we can have decent relationships with other nations, again, particularly the global South. We have to change our policy. It is not helping us. It is hurting the world, and many people are suffering as a result of this policy. But I guess I shouldn't say unfortunately. Fortunately, unfortunately, I don't think other nations feel that they are in a position to trash the dollar in this way. So we have to come up with something more collaborative, and it requires a great change in the direction of the United States.
The Chinese economy has not only pulled ahead of the U.S., any effort to bring U.S. manufacturing back home, which has happened, will ultimately fail, since many of its primary products used in manufacturing need to be imported, and the number one destination is China. Meanwhile, China is moving fast to dump the dollar, as evidence in how it has replaced the dollar with the yuan in over 50% of its trade. I'm Kyarash Punamati, and I'll see you next week.
Suffering within, this is the love has dyed me in blood. Nor that I'm wise, neither mad. Your love caused me all the joy, took my heart and made fond of it. Desire to kill. Come and see what love has done to me. Come and see what love has done to me. Got me deeply involved in despair. Come and see what love has done to me. Come and has done to me, got me deeply involved in this pain. Now and then, like the winds I blow. Now and then, like the roads I go. Now and then, like the floods I flow. I'm your mystic of sorrow, suffering once from top to toe. In the hands of beloved, I write in woe. Come and see what love has done to me. Come and see what love has done to me. Got me deeply involved in this pain.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters in faith who are listening to RIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad. I'm the host of this show. In this episode, we're going to talk about one of the sayings of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, that is very influential, and we can learn many lessons from that.
Ya hayyu ya qayyum.
One of the things that Imam Khomeini said is that arrogance and negligence will destroy the human being. We have to be really careful that we are not too proud of ourselves, that we are not the victims of arrogance. We shouldn't think that since we are Muslims, we are better than anyone else. We shouldn't think that we are better than other Muslims because, I don't know, like you pray or you do the wajibat, you probably avoid sins. You should never judge people, firstly. And secondly, you should not think that you are better than others. The Quran says, when it talks about the shaitan, about Satan, Allah says, وَلَا يَغُرَّنَّكُمْ بِاللَّهِ الْغَرُورِ. It means be careful that you are not deceived by Satan, thinking that since you are a good person, then it's done. You know, it's like, that's it. You don't need to worry about anything else. That's not how it works. As a matter of fact, you have to be really, really careful that as a Muslim, you have khushu and khudur. You are humble. You have humility.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi.
Sallallahu alayhi.
Salli ala
think that you are lower than others, even if you're actually higher than them. Okay? You have to be down to earth, especially with regard to Allah and His servants. You should never think that since you have Allah, since you are a Muslim, you have everything and you have nothing to worry about. That's not true. You have to always have this fear that what if Allah is not pleased with me? What if I'm on the wrong path? What if what I'm doing is not something that Allah wants from me? Okay? So you should keep on questioning yourself. And at the same time, you have to be hopeful of the future. You have to be hopeful in Allah's mercy. Okay? So, but you should never become arrogant, because it will destroy you. Even the best Muslims, the best scholars, the best pious servants of Allah could become the most wretched human beings on earth if they become arrogant, if they feel that they are better than others.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
There was a spring of truth, a selection of Imam Khomeini's viewpoints.
Never forget to say La ilaha illallah.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we expose the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's show, we'll be exposing Nigel Farage's right-wing Reform UK, which raises itself as a populist movement that prioritises the interests of the British people. But the reality is, it's yet another political party that's enthralled to Israel, and is being bankrolled by Zionists, as Latif Abouchaker will explain in our first report.
A new and more dangerous phase of Islamophobia has been launched in the UK, spearheaded by the Zionist asset Tel Aviv's Tommy Robinson. A rise of Islamophobic street violence and the largest ever far-right demonstration in the UK has heightened worries about a far-right government led by Reform UK. But what is the relationship between Reform and the Zionist movement? Here is Israel's deputy ambassador to the UK in September this year, praising Reform for the support the party has given to the Jewish state. We were not prepared for the warmth and the reception that we received here this morning. I want to thank you for it, Daniela Grodzki told a fringe event of around 100 party members on Friday morning. A Reform Friends of Israel group is reportedly being set up. This month, Farage met with genocider Isaac Herzog, the president of the Zionist entity. Richard Tice, one of the five Reform MPs, announced that he would visit the Zionist regime. Reform MP Lee Anderson previously went on a fully funded Conservative Friends of Israel trip to the Zionist colony. Farage himself has a long history of Islamophobic remarks, and in recent months, he has made his Zionism increasingly clear. In 2024, he said, "We have a growing number of young people in this country who do not subscribe to British values, who in fact loathe much of what we stand for." The interviewer asked if they were talking about Muslims, to which the politician replied, "We are. And I'm afraid I found some of the recent surveys saying that 46% of British Muslims support Hamas, support a terrorist organization that is proscribed in this country." Very recently, he said, "There's almost a competition between the Greens, the Liberal Democrats, Labour, whatever Jeremy Corbyn is going to call his outfit, almost a competition who can be the most beastly to Israel." He also said, "There are an awful lot of Jewish people scared to go out on the streets, given the situation we're in." Unsurprisingly, Zionists have been queuing up to splash cash on reform, as data at the Electoral Commission has shown. Roger Nagioff, financier and former treasurer of the Zionist Movement for Reform Judaism, gave £100,000 to reform in 2024. Robert Cengiz, the Iraqi Jewish tycoon, gave £50,000 in 2025 via R20 Advisory Limited. Gary Mond gave £10,000 in 2024. Mr. Mond was famously too racist for the genocidal extremists of the Board of Deputies who expelled him. There's no doubt about it. Nigel Farage and Reform UK are Zionist assets.
As usual, I'm joined in the studio by David Miller, who's the UK's foremost scholarly critic of Israel and our resident expert. He's co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. Joining us as our guest contributor today is an academic and emeritus professor of criminology at Teesside University, Steve Hall. He's the co-founder of Ultra Realism, which creates a theoretical framework for understanding crime and harm in the context of a contemporary neoliberal capitalist society. He's also an esteemed author, and his books include The Rise of the Right, which examines English nationalism and the transformation of working class politics, and more recently, The Death of the Left, that explains how the left has shifted its focus from class politics to identity politics. Welcome to the show. David, what's this barrage of announcements about reform and the Zionist entity all about?
Well, what's going on here is that the Zionist entity are trying to work out how best they can pressure British politics. They, of course, have massive influence in the Labour Party and the Conservative Party. They don't think that Lib Dems will do anything, but they are influential there as well. And so they're just trying to work out whether reform is their next candidate to take over the government of this country. Now, that's a very worrying idea, but what it shows is that they are keen to play all sides. They're absolutely happy to buy off Keir Starmer and to support him with the resources, but if he does anything at all which they don't like, such as, for example, recognise the Palestinian state, well then they will work with their other assets in the Conservative Party, in reform, and indeed the Islamophobic street movements on the streets like Tel Aviv, Tommy Robinson, then they will use them as well. And of course, they use them to play all sides against each other, and what they're trying to do here is trying to bring reform in to be the next government, and that's the truth of it.
Okay, well, Steve, I mean, how did you come to find out about the infiltration of the far-right populists like the English Defence League?
Well, we conducted a research project about 10, 11 years ago. Members of the English Defence League, they were quite common up in the old industrial zones in the north of England and around Birmingham. And we were a team of ethnographers. We'd been working in criminology departments around the country, part of what we call the Ultra Realist Network. And what was quite remarkable was that they started to talk about Israel and their support for Israel in a way that was quite unprompted. Mm. We didn't ask them about it. They turned the conversation that way themselves. So we were talking about general politics. We were talking about their loss of faith in the Labour Party. Most of them were former Labour voters, and they were, you know, being out of work or living in some locales that were virtually derelict, couldn't find decent work. Some were involved in petty crime, and they expressed allegiance for Israel just out of the blue, and that was, we thought, quite remarkable. Because we hadn't prompted it, we hadn't began, you know, to discussion. We hadn't started off a discussion about that geopolitics in any ways at all. So that was the beginning of it, and that alerted us to the possibility that there were sort of Zionist influences operating at ground level. So it's not just from the top in you know, politics in Westminster and the rest of it. They were operating on the ground and influencing members of the British public.
Yes, indeed, because it's not something you would expect somebody in the northeast of England, sort of just out of the blue, start talking about another entity elsewhere in the world. But David, just moving back to you then, I mean, you know, you've spoken, haven't you, about Zionist Islamophobia. I mean, just explain what you mean by that.
So, I mean, Islamophobia is the hatred of people because they're Muslim or appear to be Muslim. It's a form of racism. And of course, it's mushroomed since 9/11. with all the attacks that have been from this, from the British state, the American state, and other countries against Muslim populations. But that, of course, is the perspective you have, people generally have. But the underneath of all of that, of course, is the fact that the Zionists have, for many, many years, since the 1980s, in fact, been pushing the idea that the specific main threat against Western civilization is the Muslims. Used to be the Soviet Union, and now it's the Muslims. And they've been pushing that for a long, long time through various conferences. We've talked about this before, the Jonathan Institute conference in 1984 in Washington, D.C., run by Benjamin Netanyahu, the very same person who's currently the prime minister of the Zionist entity. So there's a specific Zionist component to the pushing of Islamophobia. And that's in part why most Western European countries have adopted counterterrorism policies which are specifically anti-Muslim. It's not just because of their intelligence services and their foreign policy interests, but because there's been a push specifically from the Zionists.
Right, okay. Well, Steve, Nigel Farage has a long history, doesn't he, of Islamophobic remarks?
Well, he does, yes. I mean, you know, I remember videos and photographs of Nigel Farage, you know, walking along the street with members of the National Front in the 1970s. One would love to be a fly on the wall, or perhaps not love to be. It would have been an unpleasant experience. But as a researcher looking for data, it would have been good to be a fly on the wall to you know, just to hear what was going on, what was being spoken of. But what we saw, I think, from the 1970s was a slow shift, as David Miller has just said, from anti-communism, anti-socialism amongst the hard right, towards Islamophobia. And indeed, when we conducted the research amongst the English Defence League 10, 11 years ago, we found that Islamophobia was the focus of their ire and the focus of their hatred. So they were pro-Zionists, pro-Israel, even though upon, you know, questioning, we did take that a little further, they didn't know anything about Israel. They didn't know anything about the history of Palestine, the history of the Israeli occupation or anything. They were just pro-Israel because that they thought that was the thing to be, and they were Islamophobic because they thought that Islam was their enemy, that Muslim immigrants were culturally distant and alienated from them, and their culture was a threat, and that their economic position was a threat. Yeah. You know, the usual tropes about taking all the jobs and all of this.
Well, David, I mean, you were sort of touching on this just a moment ago, but the prominent Zionists, I mean, have been throwing a lot of money at reform, haven't they? I mean, from what you were just saying earlier on, and it seems to me that, you know, is this just another attempt for the Zionist lobby to buy yet another political party?
Well, of course it is, yes, and that's what we showed in the film there, some of the key people who've given money. These are not the only people who've given money, but there's a Zionist component to the funding of reform, and we can show that with the data which has been disclosed to the Electoral Commission. And some of these people are, of course, in all sorts of odd financial industry places, and one or two of them are based in Monaco and not actually in the country, and so all this stuff about Britain first and Britain for the British, at the same time as the people who are funding this party, actually not even based in the country. So yeah, the traditional nonsense you get from that. But this is a specific Zionist push to put money into the party. But at the same time as the Zionist entity itself, the you saw the deputy ambassador there, the president, and the foreign minister just the other day, you know, actually making overtures towards reform, and they're pushing them to take centre stage in British politics.
No, indeed. Well, Steve, I mean, I saw that Gideon Sahar, the Zionist entity's current Minister of Foreign Affairs, posted on X the other day about his phone conversation with Nigel Farage. I mean, are they just withdrawing support for the Labour government, do you think, or are they just sort of playing both horses?
Well, I think I tend to take David Miller's position that it's an all-round attempt to court political parties, because we're in a volatile situation at the moment economically. We're seeing the rise of BRICS, we're seeing the possible decline of the West, we're seeing the dollar tanking, we're seeing all sorts of volatile events taking place at the moment. And politics are on the back of that, of course, are equally volatile. So we don't really know what's going to happen. We've seen the Labour Party tank And in the polls, we've seen reform rise. We're seeing the Greens rising at the moment. The Greens are presenting more feasible economic policies. So I think that the Zionists have a tough job at the moment. They have to guess who's going to be the next government. They're going to guess who's going up and down in the polls. And they're just trying an all-round blanket approach, which must be quite difficult. But, of course, they're experts at this. You know, if you read Ilhan Papp, for instance, Zionist lobbying on both sides of the Atlantic, they've been doing this for a very, very long time. And the only real people that are resisting are amongst the left and some of the old traditional one-nation conservatives, people like Peter O'Byrne and others who are against this sort of thing.
Our next report explains why right-wing TV news outlets like GB News are constantly running cover for Israel's atrocities.
The Reform leader, Nigel Farage, is a presenter on GB News. The Parliamentary Register of Interests shows he made nearly £400,000 from GB News since August 2024, more than £2,000 an hour. But who owns GB News? Legatum, a private investment fund based in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. The UAE normalized ties with Israel through the Abraham Accords in 2020. The agreement covers cooperation in diplomacy, trade, tourism, and investment. The UAE exhibits chronic Zionism and total subservience to Israel. Legatum also funded a think tank in London, now called the Prosperity Institute. In 2021, academic Matt Goodwin was appointed director of the Center for UK Prosperity, and he remains a senior advisor. Goodwin also presents a show on GB News. Here he is claiming to be Britain first. Watch his reaction to being asked about supporting Israel.
I don't want that. I want a national unifying politics which puts Britain first, not Pakistan, not Gaza, not any other foreign policy thing. Britain first.
Not Israel? Not Israel?
Israel is a very close ally. Well, until recently, it was a very close ally of the United Kingdom. We should look after our allies. Unfortunately,
no, we shouldn't.
Unfortunately,
we should look after
Britain. Unfortunately, Israel no longer feels that we are a reliable ally, thanks to the Labour government.
When GB News was set up in 2020, genocidal Zionist Jonathan Sacerdoti was employed for 4 months as a pre-launch development consultant. Sacerdoti was previously with the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism and is now a settler colonist in Tel Aviv. He recently traveled to the UK, where he could be found shilling for Tel Aviv Tommy Robinson in London on YouTube. From the beginning, GB News has been a Zionist asset.
Well, blimey, David. I mean, GB News is plowing loads of money, isn't it? Loads of money into the Nigel Farage and other right-wing figures, isn't it?
Well, that's right. I mean, the figures are there in the package, but I mean, it's worth repeating them, isn't it? £400,000 in the last year, 1 year, for presenting a show on GB News. I mean, that's just truly extraordinary. And of course, Farage pays it to his company, charges VAT, doesn't have to pay personal tax, and it pays corporation tax, and thus, of course, he exploits the exchequer. A little bit more. His company's, of course, offshore. He says it's not illegal. No, but it's certainly immoral. And of course, doesn't fit with the alleged policies of the party. And then Matt Goodwin. I mean, he's a kind of academic who's become this kind of poster boy for the far right. I guess he's moved more further right than he used to be. I mean, he used to work in a department where I used to work in. Before I got there, in Bath, and he's really very, very far to the right now, very in with the kind of racial and ethnic prejudice boys, and works for Legatum. So he's both working for Legatum and being paid for that, and working for GB News and being paid for that by Legatum.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, we don't of course have any register of interest for him, but it would be very interesting to see how much money he's getting.
Absolutely,
paid.
It certainly would. Well, Steve. Reform voters are less likely than any other party to approve of a Palestinian state, aren't they?
That's right. And we did our research. Of course, the Reform voters and a lot of these voters have been formally connected to these street protest groups, the EDL, etc. A lot of crossover from movements like Britain First, and but also to speaking of good women, attracting a lot of former Labour voters. We have this strange diversion of former Labour and left wing voters over into the far right. So the Reform voters are coming in from various positions. And it seems that the Zionist influence has a sort of pan-influential position where they've been, influencing various political positions across the spectrum. So this is quite dangerous. I think that Reform voters aren't coming specifically from a lineage from the 70s of the old far right. They're being drawn in from a lot of positions now, which our research has tended to show. So I think we're in a very difficult position.
Yeah, we certainly seem to be. But David, I mean, we mentioned this firm, Legatum. I mean, just tell me a bit more about them, will you?
So it's a firm, right? It's an investment firm. It's based, as we said, in the United Arab Emirates. There's one guy who was in charge of it, and he's now brought on three other guys. So there's four of them at the top of it. And they do little videos saying how lovely it is and how they get on fantastically with each other while they're ripping off people all over the world. So they make huge sums of money. They're in a part of the UAE where there's no tax, where they can repatriate all the profits to wherever they want to. And no doubt some of them go offshore as well. So that's the company. Now, the company, set up this think tank called the Legatum Institute in the UK some time ago. It's now called the Prosperity Institute. And they also, of course, have a foundation where they give money to all sorts of right-wing causes. And they have GB News. So it's an operation which spans quite a range of activities. It's making money, it's spending money on propaganda, and it's spending money on think tanks and research and the kind of lobbying that goes with that. So that it's a kind of interesting organisation from that point of view. And, of course, it's based in the United Arab Emirates, which is the closest state in the West Asia to the Zionists. That's what the Zionists want. It leads on taking other West Asian states towards the normalisation, such as, for example, the Saudis and Bahrain as well, and other countries too. So it's a key location, not just for the tax reasons, but also for the normalisation with Israel.
I mean, it sounds quite benign in some ways, doesn't it? Promoting prosperity, but who's the prosperity for?
Well, it's for those people, isn't it? It's for people who are making the profits offshore, not paying any tax, and of course they're operating, the think tank operates in this country, but the people who supply them with the money don't pay any tax in this country, they pay it all.
But these people claim that they're championing the working classes of Britain.
Well, of course they do, that they're very, very far from that.
Yeah, it certainly seems to be that way. But Steve, I mean, that clip though with Matt Goodwin, I mean, it says a lot, doesn't it, about the so-called Britain First movement, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly does, and it says a lot about the other movements on the right. And I think what we have to look at here is that, organic reproduction, sorry to use that technical term, but I'll explain what I mean. What we're talking about so far is the sort of manufacture of consent model, propaganda coming from top and through institutions, mass media, education and all the rest. And that's difficult enough to deal with. But the problem is that it becomes organic once this word spreads along the ground. This is what we found, that being as Islamophobic and pro-Zionist was becoming an unthinking norm. It's just by word of mouth spreading around the place. You shouldn't be anti-Zionist, you should be pro-Zionist. You shouldn't like Muslims, you shouldn't like Islam, you should hate Iran. They're authoritarian and all the rest of it, the same as China and Russia, of course. And when it becomes organic, then it becomes even more difficult to deal with. And we've got to somehow get in on the grassroots, on the ground, and start to change perceptions. Yeah. So we have a very, very, people like Goodwin, mouthpieces like Goodwin are to a penny. But it's when it starts to reproduce itself organically that we really have something desperately difficult to deal with. And it's about time that we started to address that issue.
Yeah, indeed. Got a classic case of manufacturing consent, it seems, Steve. But Dave, just tell a bit more with you about this Jonathan, this character Jonathan Sakodati, for us, will you?
So this is a guy who first came to public attention 10 years ago, where he'd been the I think one of the vice presidents of the Zionist Federation of the UK, and I think around 2015 or so, he was started to appear on the TV news as coming from this think tank, the Institute for Middle Eastern Democracy or something like that. You can look it up on his LinkedIn page. And he would appear on TV on the BBC as an expert. And one of the things we did at the time was we said, actually, this guy's from the Zionist Federation.
You shouldn't be saying
he's from the...
No, indeed.
And they actually had to stop doing that. So he went from there to work for the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism. He was their press officer for a while, which of course was engaged in fabricating anti-Semitism scare stories, and still, of course, is engaged in the very same today, taking you to court next month.
Yeah.
So there was that, and then of course he moved on to do the stuff with GB News, and then he went off to become a settler columnist, and he has a role in GB News, and he appears on Fox and all the right-wing news things. So he's a voice for hire. And he now, of course, is shilling for television for Tommy Robinson.
Sure. Well, Steve, finally, and briefly, because we've not got much time, but what's your overall view about the possibility of any section of the British right breaking from Zionism now? I mean, we know about Nick Griffin, the former British National Party leader, who's very critical of Zionism, but he seems to be a bit of an outlier, doesn't he?
Well, he does, yes, and there have been outliers throughout the history, both the left and the right. We had, in the Labour Party, people like Christopher Mayhew in the 60s, and people like, more recently, Alan Duncan in the Conservative Party, people like Peter Oburn, but they're all outliers. And this is why I stress my point again, it's becoming organic. It's not about manufacturing consent as much as how the consent is starting to manufacture itself, and that puts us in a very, very difficult situation.
But I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. But we'll be back next week. I'd like to thank our guest, Professor Steve Hall, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. So until next time, when I hope you'll join us again on Palestine Declassified, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
The earth and the heavens begin to sing. The angels celebrate the birth of a king. A king who outshines the stars of the night. A beacon of hope. You guide us with your love.
the beautiful name you bear. The blessings of God upon you is my prayer. The earth and the heavens begin to sing. This day we celebrate the birth of a king.
Greetings once again, dear listeners. This is Iran Radio from Tehran, the vibrant capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Here's what's waiting for you next on your radio station. We'll bring you the very latest updates. It's time for our news segment this hour. Stay informed with the top headlines and breaking stories from around the world. After this, prepare for profound insights with Minbar. In this program, we present selected excerpts from the speeches of the renowned Islamic scholars, covering a wide range of topics including ethics, theology, Quranic interpretation, Islamic history, and at times, social and political issues. Minbar brings the voices of the pulpit to life, timeless words that inspire thought, faith, and action. Following this program, we have another segment of radio productions for this hour. We sincerely hope you enjoy it. Finally, we present leaders' speech. Listen to English translations of the selected segments and speeches by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on various occasions. A concluding moment of guidance and reflection. Up next is news this hour. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The Yemeni army has launched another anti-Israeli operation in support of the oppressed Palestinian people, striking the regime's targets in the occupied territories with missiles and drones. The Israeli military's genocidal campaign in Gaza continues to take more Palestinian lives, with the regime bombing two major hospitals in Gaza City. And finally, this hour, Iran's president says the Islamic Republic will never give in to dictates of the world bullies, but is ready to engage in fair and logical talks. Hello and welcome, everyone, your world news. Let's go ahead and get started with the stories that matter. The Yemeni army has launched another anti-Israeli operation in support of the oppressed Palestinian people, striking the regime's targets in the occupied territories with missiles and drones. The missile strike set off air raid sirens in more than 200 locations, including Tel Aviv, El Quds, and the southern part of the occupied West Bank.
Triumphing for the oppressed Palestinian people and their dear mujahideen, and in response to the crimes of genocide and the dangerous escalation carried out by the Israeli enemy against our people in the Gaza Strip, and within the framework of responding to the Israeli aggression against our country, the missile force of the Yemeni armed forces carried out a qualitative military operation using a Palestine 2 hypersonic ballistic missile with multiple warheads, targeting several sensitive targets in the occupied Jaffa area. The operation successfully achieved its objectives and caused millions of herds of usurping Zionists to flee to shelters. The UAV force of the Yemeni armed forces carried out a qualitative military operation